Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. There are 30,000 stories in the Boston Marathon, one for every runner in the race. And this year, we may have saved one of the best for last. Because this morning, in the pale pre-dawn light, shortly before 5 a.m., Michael Melamed crossed the finish line in Copley Square, the last person to complete the 119th Boston Marathon. Melamed says he has nerve damage caused during his birth, which makes it difficult for him to get around, but he pushed himself for 20 hours to complete the 26.2-mile course. It's an absolutely amazing story, and WBUR's Fred Tice joins us now with more. Hi there, Fred.
Hi, Meghna.
So what did Michael say today about running all night and in the morning through the rain to finish the marathon?
So he says this is his fifth marathon. That he ran New York in 2011. It took him more than 15 hours. In Chicago in 2013, that took 17 hours. He wanted to save Boston for last because Boston was special to him because he went to Children's Hospital to get treatment for the disabilities caused by his childbirth. He says that it really got tough for him at mile 24. You're talking about Audubon Circle, more or less, because at that point he just really found it very hard to keep going. But his method kept him going. He says what he does is he does X number of steps. I think he said about 40 steps. Then he rests for a few minutes and he keeps going again. And the crowd, you know, was counting out the steps for him, he says. And so that is what he says impelled him to continue all the way to the very end. He says, it's a marathon, right? So the marathon always asks you in the last mile, why are you doing it? And this is the answer he gave to us.
I'm running for you. I'm running to send the message that raise the bar of their own expectation of yourself. I mean, everyone can have more expectation of themselves because the human power is infinite. I'm not crossing the finish line. We, as a team, cross the finish line.
And he had a whole team of supporters from this TV show in Venezuela. Not clear to us whether they're supporting his travels or not. And he also mentioned therapists whom we did not see there, who he says worked with him.
Right. Amazing. Fred, he was on the course for 20 hours. And as we said, he has nerve damage that he says was caused during his birth. So how did he appear today?
So today he was in a wheelchair because I hadn't seen the footage that apparently was on TV this morning of him crossing that finish line. I got a little confused because he was talking about taking steps and then resting, right? So I asked him if he was walking or if he was in the wheelchair for the race, and here's what he had to say.
For you, I walk. For me, I was running, my friend. Because I was at the maximum level of myself in the whole course. But I was running, and the chair is because now I'm really hurt.
And who can blame him? Well, that's Michael Melamed, the final person to finish the 119th Boston Marathon. He did it in 20 hours, and he crossed the finish line at just before 5 o'clock this morning. An amazing story brought to us today by WBUR's Fred Tice. Fred, thanks so much.
Oh, glad to do it, Meghna.
Okay, so as broadcasters, we're taught to write in clear, active, declarative sentences. This means we try to avoid saying things like, having promised to enact legislation that would exhort by a multitude of means, including criminal penalties, the governor affected the execution of a law to improve written composition for the advancement of comprehension. I couldn't even read that. That was so awfully written. Instead, we would say, today, the governor made good on his promise and signed a law that makes bad writing a crime. That's better and clearer. So let's talk about why there's so much bad writing out there and how to write well. And to do this, we're going to use some insights from linguistics and neuroscience. That's the approach Steven Pinker takes in his latest book, The Sense of Style, The Thinking Person's Guide to Writing in the 21st Century. Pinker is a cognitive scientist and linguist at Harvard. He joined us last fall when his book was first released, and we began by asking him why, with the existence of this seemingly timeless, strunken white manual, he felt compelled to write a new style guide now.
Well, I love Strunk and White. Everyone loves Strunk and White. But, you know, the junior member of that team, E.B. White, was born before the turn of the century. That is, the turn of the 20th century.
Yeah.
So although there's a lot of lovely advice in Strunk and White, there are a lot of parts that are obsolete. And also, there's a lot of advice that isn't so good. And, you know, you can't blame them. Their intuitions were formed more than 100 years ago. And the language has moved on, and the science of language has moved on. They kind of used their own rules of thumb, their own pet peeves, their own intuitions. We can do a bit better now because we know a lot more about how language works.
Yeah. So before we talk about some of the practical applications that you explore in the book, I would actually love to spend a minute or two exploring the science of language, as you say, and how it's moved on. Because you talk a lot about what goes on in the minds of readers, the mental dynamics of reading. I mean, explain a couple of them, like this idea of memory load.
Yes. So as you when you think about it, how do you understand a sentence? We don't take in the entire sentence in one glance. Our eye hops from word to word to word. Just like when we listen, one word comes into our ear at a time. So to hook up all the parts in the sentence to figure out who did what to whom, there's a memory load. You've got to keep strings of words in short-term memory as you figure out what they're doing, whether it's the doer or the done to or just a modifier or setting the stage for the time and place. And that means that sentences have a memory load that waxes and wanes over the course of the sentence, and a clumsy writer will often overload the reader's memory.
Uh-huh.
And in many laboratory studies that either look at eye movements, how long does it take for your eye to hop from one word to another? And if it takes a long time, you figure that person must be lingering on the previous word and having trouble digesting it. And some studies have people wear a hairnet of electrodes that contact the scalp and measure brain waves emanating through the skull. And you can tell when the brain boggles, when it's an objective wiggle of the needle that tells you that person was just surprised by what they saw and is having a lot of trouble assimilating it.
Oh, interesting. So one lesson then for writers is remember and understand your readers or your audience's basic brain tolerance for the volume or pace of information that you're giving them.
So one way that translates into practical advice is if you've got a big, hairy, complicated phrase, move it to the end of the sentence so that the reader doesn't have to hold it in mind while they're figuring out the structure of the sentence. So you want to say he sent the poison candy that he received in the mail to the police. That's harder than he sent to the police the poison candy he received in the mail,
right,
for example.
So you have early in the book a couple examples of good writing and how they employ maybe unconsciously some of these findings or understandings that we know about how the brain works. You quote from Richard Dawkins in the first sentence of one of his books. Oh, his Unweaving the Rainbow, that's right, where he writes, "We are going to die, and that makes us the lucky ones."
Well, a principle of good style is to start strong. When Dawkins starts off, "We're going to die, and that makes us the lucky ones," he wallops you with the most unpleasant fact there is, followed by a bit of a paradox. How could it be lucky that we'll die? And that leads you into the explanation that follows.
Well, there's so much to discuss in your book, and I just wanted to read one little passage that you wrote that seems to distill what a lot of the authors that you point to as very strong writers share, the characteristics that they share. You write that they have an insistence on fresh wording and concrete imagery over familiar verbiage and an abstract summary, an attention to the reader's vantage point and the target of their gaze, an important point we'll come back to, the judicious placement of an uncommon word or idiom, the use of parallel syntax, the occasional planned surprise, which I love, the presentation of a telling detail that obviates an explicit pronouncement, and the use of meter and sound that resonate with the meaning and mood. I mean, is that sort of your recipe right there for good writing?
That helps, and especially going beyond merely competent prose to prose that gives pleasure to readers, that where the reader doesn't just know what the writer means, but thinks, oh, I really enjoyed reading that passage. Those are some of the ingredients. And that all sounds very abstract, and it violates my rule, don't be abstract.
Yeah.
But it comes at the end of a discussion where I illustrate each of those keys to good writing.
Exactly. So the one that I wanted to focus on for a moment was where you talk about basically that good writing realizes that it's in conversation with the reader. And you talk about it in terms of this thing called classic style, which was first explained, as you note, in a book called Clear and Simple as the Truth by Francis Noel Thomas and Mark Turner. I have to say, I'd never heard of this book. So Who are they and what is classic style?
It is sadly obscure. I think it's a brilliant book because time and again, as I was reading it, I thought, yes, that's what makes prose good prose. And a lot of it just hinges on the right attitude, the right mental model of what you're doing when you're writing. Because when you're writing, you're in an artificial situation. Your reader is not there. You have no idea who the reader is. You know, you might be dead when they're reading your prose. They can't bite into the conversation. They can't furrow their brow. What are you doing when you're writing? And every prose style has a particular pretend scenario. And the one that leads to clear prose, which they call classic style, is the following. You, the writer, have noticed something in the world. It's objectively out there. Your reader, who is your equal, happens not to have noticed it yet. Your job as the writer is to point out something in the world that the reader can see with her own eyes if only you give her an unobstructed view. Uh-huh. And the reader and writer are equals, and the style is conversation. So those are the ingredients of classic style. And a lot of the advice on how to avoid professionalese and bureaucraties and academies can really be boiled down to remember that scenario. Remember that's what you're doing as a writer.
Right. So you are helping someone see the world with concrete examples.
You're helping someone see the world. You're not, you're using language as a window onto the world. Yeah.
And as you write in your book, that's the strongest cure I know for the disease that enfeebles academic, bureaucratic, corporate, legal, and official prose. I mean, there is a lot of very bad, verbose writing out there. I mean, before we move on to those particular types of prose, why do you think there is so much bad writing out there?
You know, bad writing is easy. Good writing is hard. A lot of people think that bureaucrats and academics deliberately write in obscure verbiage to hide the fact that they have nothing to say or to keep outsiders out, to boast about what experts they are. But actually, I think that's a little bit too much like a conspiracy theory. It's actually easy to write pompous, turgid, academic gobbledygook. It's hard to write plain, simple English sentences.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about academic writing for just a moment, because I know a lot of our listeners...
My private pain.
Indeed. And if I may, I just want to read a little bit of an example of how complicated academies can be. Because I was just looking at a paper that appeared in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences this year, in fact. And it begins with, here we apply an alternative two-stage research strategy, which we call the proxy phenotype method. In the first stage, we conduct a GWAS on a proxy phenotype to identify a relatively small set of SNPs that are associated with the proxy phenotype. And then it goes on. This is by a group of a large group of authors,
yes,
including Reitfeld C. et al. And the et al., of course, includes one Steven Pinker.
It does indeed. I confess. Absolutely.
I just bring up this example, though, because a lot of what's easy to point to and deride in academic writing is meant for a particular audience, though. I mean, this was in a scholarly journal.
It is, although it's a lame excuse, because the excuse that we have a lot of technical concepts, we need to use shorthand, that is certainly true. But a lot of things that academics say don't make things any clearer or more succinct, and they just didn't do the work to make it as clear as they could. So even papers in my field aimed at people like me, I often find impenetrable. Yeah. So the idea is we're writing for our own clubhouse doesn't fly.
Well, in your new book, though, you bring up a reason behind it, which I think is worth some exploration. You call it the curse of knowledge, that people can't even imagine that their audience or their readers don't know what they know. And that may be one of the reasons behind all this terrible writing.
I think it's the main reason behind a lot of terrible writing. That is, all of us overestimate how good we are at reading minds. That's even when we try to read minds. More often, we don't even try. We just assume that what we know, the whole world knows. And so we don't bother to spell out the acronyms. We don't explain the technical terms. We don't give concrete examples of abstractions. We talk about a stimulus and a post-stimulus event, where what we mean is a tap on the elbow and a tap on the shoulder. And notice saying that a tap on the elbow is no less precise precise. It's more precise. It doesn't take any more words. It takes fewer words. There's absolutely no reason to avoid it if your goal is clarity. But academics don't write that way, simply because when you're in any business long enough, you start to think about your subject matter more and more abstractly. Uh-huh. You forget about the concrete details, the things that you drop on your foot, the people who are actually making things happen, and you package them into abstractions, like stimulus, like prevention, like amelioration. Whereas your poor reader, they need something to visualize. They need to see something. And that's what you forget when you become an expert.
Right. And this harkens back to what we know about how readers' brains work, because you point out in the book that, the majority of the brain, or a huge portion of the brain, is dedicated to the visual.
Yes, yeah. That's right. We're primates. We see, we hear. We have, sitting on top of all this ancient brain tissue, some ability to think abstractly. But our most natural way of thinking is to imagine things. And a good writer allows his reader to imagine things.
So once again, we come back to that call of remember the reader always. And considering the reader on equal footing. I love that as a rule to good writing. Steven Pinker, in the last couple minutes that we have here, I can't let you go without us ruffling some grammarian feathers. Because the last third of the book, you really pick a lot of sort of tried and true, or presumptively tried and true rules about writing that you call bogus, and why, and you give reasons why you want to break them, such as never split an infinitive. Why is that a bogus rule?
It's not the way English works. They're the most natural place for an adverb often is between the to and the verb. When Captain Kirk said to boldly go where no man has gone before, he was not making a grammatical error.
The rule originally comes from the fact that Latin verbs, there was no separate to and the verb.
Yes, because it was a single word, likewise in French and other Romance languages. But English doesn't work that way. And you place the adverb where it fits both the rhythm and the meaning, and very often that's between the to and the verb.
Okay, so how about no prepositions at the ends of sentences? This is a rule you'd like to get rid of, if I might
say. There's a rule of which I'd like to get rid. Yes. Again, it's just not a rule. The idea that it's a rule is just a fallacy. Historians trace it to a snarky essay by, I think it was Dryden, trying to imply that Ben Jonson was an inferior poet because he put prepositions at the end of the sentence. That's all it amounts to. There's no reason not to end a sentence with a preposition. It's you she's thinking of. It's you of whom she's thinking. She loves you, yeah, 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 would not work nearly as well if it's you of who she's thinking. Yeah. A lot of the experts confuse informal style with incorrect grammar.
So this brings me to my final question. I mean, here we are in the 21st century, and as your book, the subtitle says, it's the thinking person's guide to writing in the 21st century. I mean, it's obvious that language is fluid, it's alive, it morphs according to the time, context, and culture in which it's being used, or that it's being used in. I'm going to say that from now on. But you do also, in the book, you say there are some rules that are worth sticking by. So I was just wondering, sort of broadly speaking, why not just throw open the door with some, I don't know, James Joycean fervor and say anything goes when it comes to how we write well or use language well?
Because James Joyce, when he wrote long passages with no punctuation and very loose grammar, he was actually trying to achieve an effect, namely a peek into someone's consciousness. So he knew what he was doing. He was flouting those rules for a reason. Ordinarily, though, if you're not trying to render the stream of consciousness, if you're doing something more like classic style, namely using conversation to direct a reader's gaze, then readers have certain expectations about how the grammar works. They do change over time, but at a given time, you can look up what they are. And if you ignore them, you will often make your prose more ambiguous. You will often just confess to your readers, I haven't paid attention to the printed page in the past. You'll often confess, I don't think about what my words mean. Mm. For example, if you use literally to mean figuratively, if you say, I literally exploded, what you're saying is, I don't really care what my words mean, and your readers are less likely to trust you.
Well, listeners, it's safe to say that I literally loved this book. Steven Pinker is a professor of psychology at Harvard University. His book is called The Sense of Style, The Thinking Person's Guide to Writing in the 21st Century. Professor Pinker, what a pleasure it's been speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
That's it for today. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Come on back tomorrow and join us again for more Radio Boston.